This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Charmaine Cozier. On The Inquiry this week, we're looking at unregulated wines and spirits, including fake alcohol. What makes them toxic and how widespread are they? The Inquiry goes beyond the headlines to explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world. Search for The Inquiry wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, reactions to a high court ruling that attempted suicide should no longer be a crime punishable by a 2-year jail sentence in Kenya.
I think that's a step in the right direction because we do not actually give attention to mental health as it's supposed to be. And as a society, we do not have enough communication amongst ourselves about these issues, and they affect all of us.
We revisit the dump site in Kampala that collapsed and killed more than 30 people last August, and counting the cost of a fire that destroyed one of the largest open-air markets in Ghana.
On the 15th December, I received sneakers worth $6,800, and I already had sneakers worth $28,000 in there. On Tuesday, 31st December, I brought goods worth $2,000.
So you've lost over $30,000?
Yes. For me, just me. It's a sad moment.
How much money has your mother lost?
My mother has lost over $70,000.
No. It's Tuesday, the 14th of January. First, we go to Kenya. The High Court has struck down a law that criminalized attempted suicide in Kenya. The judge in the case said the provision in the law was unconstitutional. Justice Lawrence Mugambi reminded us all that suicidal thoughts are beyond the control of those who endure them because they emanate from bad mental health. It's worth bearing this in mind because most deaths by suicide happen in low and middle income countries. I don't know if you remember, but we had a special report last year about the prevalence of such deaths in Lesotho, which reportedly has the highest rate of death by suicide in the world. The issue is particularly live in Kenya right now. You may recall our report on the two medical students who took their own lives last year, leaving notes that cited workplace stress. Their tragic deaths sparked protest and nationwide conversations in Kenya. Several mental health campaigners have welcomed Judge Mugambi's ruling.
My name is Onyango Otieno. I am a Kenyan mental health advocate. I am so excited that we are finally having this conversation of decriminalizing suicide in Kenya and in Africa in general. One of the things that I would love to see improving in terms of mental health access in Kenya is awareness. In as much as we've been having conversations on mental health in the country in the last 6 or 7 years, in the media or in other physical spaces, a huge chunk of the country still has very limited understanding on mental health.
I am Kennedy Akuru Githinji, an author on mental wellness and an advocate of creating awareness of mental health. And as for the topic of decriminalization of suicide, I think that's a step in the right direction. And as a society, we do not have enough communication amongst ourselves about these issues, and they affect all of us, regardless of your position in society or your age. And that conversation needs to be talked on a daily basis.
It is difficult to get solid figures on the number of deaths by suicide. The Kenyan Health Ministry's suicide prevention strategy has calculated that there are about 4 deaths by suicide a day. Kenya now joins the majority of African countries that do not punish people for attempting to take their own lives. I should warn you to take care, as Dr. Mercy Karanja, a consultant psychiatrist and director of mental health at the Ministry of Health, takes up the conversation. Dr. Karanja is also the president of the Kenya Psychiatric Association, which helped argue the case in court. She told me why this law existed in the first place.
Well, you know, even several of our cultures and social attitudes, and some of them still consider that suicidal behavior is still something that really is like a misdemeanor in some cases, even in the culture. So I guess that also drove the laws. From a long time ago, during the colonial period, when our laws were being developed, our cultures, the historic use of punitive measures to address even people with other mental health issues may have brought about the whole laws that led us to this position that we were with the penal codes.
Right. You were fortunate enough to have it overturned in Kenya. But let's just stay with before the law changed for a moment longer. What was the so-called punishment if you tried to take your own life and failed? Were you prosecuted?
The community generally would take people to hospital generally. But should you land in the criminal justice system and you're prosecuted, it actually attracted a fine of being in jailed for up to 2 years.
Goodness me.
According to the law. Yes.
Okay, let's talk about the petition to repeal the law that criminalized attempted suicide. Your association was one of the petitioners. You won the case. Tell us, what was the thinking, what was the argument that you made in order to get this ruling?
So one of the things we emphasized was the violation of the constitutional rights. The constitution provides that everybody must have the highest attainable standard of health. And that includes even mental health care. And then the fact that persons entitled to equality before the law without discrimination, that is as per Article 27, and other rights like rights to human dignities and the rights of persons with disabilities. We also highlighted that we are, as a country, have ratified several international treaties, the UN conventions on the rights of persons with disabilities. Yes.
So would you consider somebody then that displays suicidal behavior somebody with a disability?
So persons with mental health conditions, some of them, they are sometimes classified as having cognitive disabilities. Remember, suicidal behavior emanates from mental illness or mental health conditions. And therefore, the CRPD do classify persons with mental illness as having psychosocial disabilities.
So what do you think was the clinching argument here? What did the judge say in the ruling?
Suicidal behavior is part of mental health issues, and therefore, again, this should not be treated as a legal issue, but a health issue. So we had several arguments, and then that if we continue having suicidal behavior treated as a crime, then that will mean we are driving stigma. In addition to driving stigma, we are also hindering health-seeking behavior for these persons who need help. And in his ruling, he stated that that section of the Penal Code was actually unconstitutional, and it was denying people their basic rights to health care.
So you spoke about the law as it stood, preventing people from going to seek health care to help them with their mental health conditions. So talk to us about the state of mental health care provision in Kenya. What makes it hard for people to get proper health care should they need it?
We find that we do not have enough mental health facilities in the country. And as you know, health in Kenya, we have a county, a national government and the county government, with health being devolved to the county government. So we find that less than 50% of the counties have mental health services in their facilities.
Is that because it's not prioritized, or is that because people have found other ways of dealing with it that doesn't fall to the state?
Mental health financing accounts for about 0.01% of the entire health financing. So you can imagine the health budget is already small, and then you only give 0.01% of that budget to mental health. And then again, we lack enough mental health professionals across board. You know, the multidisciplinary team of mental health professionals are very limited in the country. We don't have adequate psychiatrists. We have about 150 psychiatrists currently, and not all of them are in practice. Some of them are in policy, some are in teaching, academia, and research, and only a few, less than 50% of those, are in clinical practice. And quite a number of them are just concentrated in the large cities.
Why is it so under-prioritized? Is it that there were other ways of dealing with people who displayed signs of bad mental health before, and that now those structures are breaking down and therefore people are more reliant on the state? Or is it that more and more people are actually presenting with mental health problems and that the provision can't keep up with the demand?
I think there are several issues that led to it not being prioritized. One is the stigma, systemic stigma. People assume that people don't die from mental health issues, and a public health approach would prioritize diseases that are likely to lead to, you know, death, mass death of people, and therefore it lacked priority. The stigma in our communities, where people don't even think that mental health is important, even when they have a person who has mental illness, they don't take them to hospital. They think that that this person is not even productive, so they don't want to spend money on these persons. Then beyond that is lack of awareness and lack of knowledge. And this is something as an association we've been working on. And you find that even healthcare workers shy away from specializing in mental health because they don't see it as a priority or a lucrative area to sub-specialize in.
So now that the legislation has been repealed, what will be the impact, you think, on access to mental health, attitudes to suicide ideation or suicidal behavior? What do you think will happen?
People are likely to seek help more, and it will open conversations around mental health and suicidal behavior in a manner where people feel they will not be condemned. We may find that there is better health-seeking behavior among these people and eventually a reduction of deaths related to suicide. When people now embrace this as actually a health issue and not a legal or criminal issue, then they will be more empathetic towards people who have suicidal behavior. More people will come forward when they have suicidal behavior. We'll get better data. And therefore, with better data, we'll be able to know what is actually the extent of the problem and what investments do we need to do as a country. With better data, now we're able to make better policies.
Dr. Mercy Karenja, president of the Kenya Psychiatric Association, which campaigned to decriminalize attempted suicide in her country. And if you need to, please seek assistance from mental health professionals or trusted individuals where you are, and you can search for resources online as well. We are revisiting a tragedy we reported on a few months ago in this story. It was the collapse of thousands of tons of waste at the biggest dump site in Kampala, the capital of Uganda. At least 30 people died back in August when it happened. The city produces around 2,000 tons of waste a day, and Kitezi is where most of it goes. 5 months after that tragedy, we are back in Kitezi to discuss why waste disposal is still a problem in Kampala. The broader picture is that fast-growing cities struggle to keep up with service provision to cater for growing populations. This is the case across the continent. So the crisis in Kampala highlights the risks this failure to manage poses, but it also points to ways in which ordinary people can bring about change. BBC Africa's Hashim Shima has been to visit Kitezi.
I went there early morning. It was around 6 a.m. When you walk in to one of the many entrances to Kitezi, and you're immediately greeted by this dense smell. Years and years and years of waste have just been dumped here, and it smells, quite awful. The ground is soft. Each step you take, you sink into the ground a little bit. I mean, the litter covers just about every imaginable object, from iPads to flip-flops to strands of hair, clothes, plastic bottles, electronic waste, you name it. Around this dump site, there's makeshift houses, temporary sort of shelters, and not just around, but some are actually wedged quite in the dump site itself. It's a community of people who sift through the trash to find items that they can resell. But really, it is quite a sight. There's steam coming out of all this trash. There's these majestic birds circling around looking for things. There's cats prowling for things they can find. It's quite dystopic, almost.
It sounds like it. I imagine that it also has other forms of vermin, rats and mice, and almost like a competition with the human beings to see who can get the best out of what's there. How long has it been operational, and how has it changed over time?
So the Gitesi dump site was established in 1996 with funding from the World Bank. The idea was for it not to be a dumping ground, rather to be done up as a landfill. There's some differences between a dump site and a landfill, and I'll tell you a little bit about how this came to be a dump site. So landfills are characterized by some planning considerations. There have to be things like incinerators, recycling plants, some vents, and so on. A dump site, however, is just a place where you come and throw your trash. So it has been operational for just about 20 years, and it has changed over time in the sense that it has expanded hectare by hectare to the point where about now it has no more space to expand except upwards. And that's the direction it's going in.
And dangerous as well, because these dump sites are famous for being very dangerous for people, notwithstanding the fact that people actually live on them and work on them and derive an income from there. Gitesi itself was the site of a major incident last year when several people died. How does the government actually respond to collapses of dump sites and the dangers that they pose for people in general?
Well, yes, in August 2024, early morning, 8 a.m., a huge section of the Gitesi dump site collapsed, killed around 30 people and buried some houses underneath as well. It made waste management a public topic. All of a sudden, people were talking about it. And it served as a bit of a wake-up call in terms of just the prominence and the importance of waste management. In many ways, a Gitesi dump site also reflects this idea that you can just keep throwing your trash and look the other way, but the problem won't go away. The collapse that happened, essentially, when you keep layering trash and piling it up on top of each other for years and years and years, the bottom sediments, the bottom layers start heating up. They're emitting gases, they're decaying, decomposing. Temperatures at the bottom becomes really hot. Now, without any vents or any system to cool off that temperature, it basically disintegrates. And so it was kind of expected that one day this a part of this dump site will obviously collapse, but it still came as a surprise. You know, what I found shocking was that there are still people living around the dump site, in the dump site, working on the dump site in pretty much the same conditions as they were before August 2024.
Tell us about the people in Kampala, because Gitesi is not very far from where they live generally. It's very near the city. What do they say about this dump site right in their midst?
Something that the companies that collect their waste are trying their best. Others think that the population growth is just too overwhelming for the government to sort of catch up with. And so there's a variety of views. I spoke to people on the streets just to get a sense of how everyday and, you know, everyday life, how do people engage with their waste? Here's a small sample of what I heard.
Some places it's managed well. Some places it is still not managed well. I think the government is overwhelmed.
We pay taxes here and there. Everything is taxed in Uganda. So I think as a give back to the people, we should as well improve their health by taking the garbage out of the city.
Hashem, those were some people on the streets of Kampala talking to you there. And people clearly feel that there are major problems. I'm just wondering, how does it actually affect them? Because you gave us very vivid descriptions of the smell of the dump, the appearance of the dump. How does it affect people?
Well, it affects people in two ways. One is their relationship with the city, and the other is the impact on the environment and their health. So when a public service such as waste management is something that seems not to be working, it obviously changes your relationship with your city. You no longer feel the sense of duty to keep things clean because there's no collective energy going into keeping everything clean. The other is obviously the environmental and health impact. There are all sorts of the waste rotting away in the Gitesi dump site. I can't imagine the kind of biological hazard that presents, not just into the air quality, but also the water that runs off downstream. So when it rains, all that water kind of sifts through this trash and goes downstream. There's people living around it, the birds that come and live there and at the dump site and then fly elsewhere. There's just a whole host of issues. And because there hasn't been a lot of audits and studies looking at the environmental and health impacts of Gitesi, it's just one of those things where you wonder just exactly how much damage has been done so far. So this is Abel Odeke. He leads the Equal Akwa Uganda volunteer group. I was with them one morning. They were doing a cleanup drive at the Gaba landing site in Kampala. Gaba is one of the more popular places on the shores of Lake Victoria. And the idea was to clean up the street and then get into boats and pick up floating pieces of trash and plastic along the coast of Lake Victoria.
Actually, we have a very big problem in Kampala with waste management, because we really realize that there is no proper system where we separate the plastic from the food materials and from the metallic kind of stuff. Because of plastic being dumped from the ground, leading to itself to the lake, and all this coming back to human consumption through eating the fish and all that. So all these are the kind of things we're trying to avoid, because there are a lot of impacts that come with microplastics.
That's Abel Odeke. Hashem, what kind of a difference do activists and activist groups like Abel make in trying to improve the environment, not just by, you know, cleaning it up, but do they exert political pressure, for instance?
Well, that's a great question. And that's one I asked Abel as well. I asked him, do you think you're making an impact and is it really changing anything? He was obviously quite positive about the fact that they are making impact. And I really saw that play out. In a sense, obviously, this group of 15, a dozen or so volunteers is not going to end up cleaning all of Kampala or sorting its waste management issues. But what they do is they play an important part in the nationwide effort, which is ultimately what is required to sort out the waste crisis. When they walk through a street, other people look at them. They see what is going on. They see that there's a group of young people who are walking through and picking up the trash along the side of the road. So it has that impact of, you know, immediately just by them being there, it sensitizes people, it educates people that, okay, trash is a problem. And plastic lining the sewage line is not going to work. Somebody has to take it out.
BBC Africa's Hashem Chima. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Charmaine Cozier. On The Inquiry this week, we're looking at unregulated wines and spirits, including fake alcohol. What makes them toxic and how widespread are they? The Inquiry goes beyond the headlines to explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world. Search for The Inquiry wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the sound of a huge fire blazing in Kantamanto Market in Accra. Nana Yao Kese watched as the fire roared across the place that had provided a living for several generations of his family. His shop, his mother's shop, that of his aunt, and his younger brother were all consumed by the flames. Hundreds of other traders from all over West Africa lost their livelihoods in the early hours of the second day of this new year. One person died in that fire, and around 14 others were injured. Nana lost more than $30,000 worth of shoes and sneakers. His mother, a seller of cloth, lost more than $70,000 worth of stock. Kantamanto Market is slowly rising from the ashes due to a huge cleanup operation. There are already plans to rebuild the market. There are school fees to be paid after all, dreams to remake. Grief is almost a luxury in this context. Nana Yao is one of those actively involved in rebuilding the market. Carpenters are measuring and hammering wood into place, creating the framework for new stalls. 28-year-old Nana took time away from the rebuilding to tell me how the fire has affected him. I began our conversation with the traditional New Year's greeting in Ghana. Afisha pa?
Yeah, afiu and come between. That means this year won't go and come back. It's not a good year.
I'm so sorry that we are reporting on something that was so tragic for you. Let's talk about you. Tell us what you do for a living and how long you've been doing it for.
I was born at Kantamanto. My late grandmother was part of the first settlers of Kantamanto in the early 80s. After school, I had to join my mother over there to sell fabrics. She sells fabrics. 2019, she took me to China. And I started my own business in 2020, which is selling of shoes, which we call sneakers here in Ghana.
Kantamanto is in your blood. Tell us about January the 1st. How did you hear about the fire?
It was a public holiday, so Kantamanto was closed down. Nobody was supposed to come there. So I was home the whole day having rest. At around January 2nd, I think 1:25 a.m., I had a call from the vice chairman. He told me Cantamantu was on fire. I told him, is he serious? He said, yes. And I asked which particular area. And he said, our site, our place. I had to rush from my house to Cantamantu. Without traffic, it's about 25-minute drive. But with traffic, you spend about an hour and a half. When we got there, it was a devastating news, and it was an eyesore. You know, we have gates. Gate 1, gate 2, gate 3, gate 4. Yeah, my shop is at gate 4. So when I got to gate 4, the fire had already passed gate 4, and it was at gate 6.
So the fire was still raging when you got there?
Yes, yes. It was a very serious fire. So when I got to gate 4, I saw the fire destroying everything. What I actually saw was people were inside stealing our goods.
Oh, no. So they were looting?
Yes. They were looting. There were a lot of people looting. They wouldn't allow you to even go into your shop because they had cutlass, they had bags, they had sacks, which...
So they were stopping you from going into your shop to try and save some of your goods, some of your profits, some of your livelihood.
When you're able to open your shop, they will enter. I couldn't take anything from my shop, so I went to a friend's shop.
I went to try and save something from there.
So when we got there, trying to take some of his items, he also sells sneakers as well. So when we were trying to bring them out, people were taking them. They were stealing. They were looting.
Do you know how the fire was started?
I don't know how the fire started. But, you know, in every rumor, there is a bit of truth. I hope you know that. We were hearing people saying they are going to take the market from us. They are going to burn the place. This was last year.
And which people were they, these that were saying that?
It was a political talk because of the election.
I know that market associations have some political power. So just explain to us a little bit more about the associations that you're talking about.
Let me say, Cantamantu supports Party A. I wouldn't mention the name of party. Cantamantu supports Party A. They don't support Party B. So it was a rumor that when Party B wins power, they are going to take the market from us. That was the rumor. And people were saying that they were going to take the market because the market doesn't belong to us. It belongs to a chief. So many talks, news that a chief wants his land back. He claims the land belongs to him.
Will you be getting any compensation, or put another way, were your goods insured in any way?
No. The insurance company, they don't insure wooden structure.
What about the goods inside, your sneakers?
It's lost. You won't get anything. You only get help from donors. But for government, for insurance, no, they won't. And I don't know if the new government will do something about it. 13 years ago, there was a fire outbreak in Cantamantu. My mother lost so much money that I had to stay home for a year because she had no money to take me to school. She used all her money for goods.
How much money have you lost this time?
Let me say this before I go there. I have my mother there, I have my auntie there, I have my kid brother there, myself. So we are four.
Different shops in the market?
Yes, okay. We have 12 shops. My mother is currently in China. She's bringing fabrics. She heard the news and I heard she was rushed to the hospital.
Oh dear. Is she better now? How is she?
Yeah, she's better now.
So we were talking about how much money you've lost. Let's start with you and think of it in dollars.
On the 15th of December, I received group sneakers worth $6,800. I have sold only half of it. And I already had sneakers worth $28,000 in there.
So you've lost all of that?
Yes. On Tuesday, 31st December, I brought goods worth $2,000.
So you've lost over $30,000?
Thousand, yes. For me, just me.
Nana, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I am so sorry.
It's a sad moment.
How much money has your mother lost?
My mother has lost over $70,000.
No. So where do you look for help now?
Those you think they can help you, they are not even picking up your calls. We need help from donors, people who are going to sympathize with us. I heard their organization trying to raise some funds for the people affected. And I would say I have no idea how much money they are bringing, because when the money comes, the people who receive the money won't disclose the exact amount They will come and give you peanuts.
Have you been back to the market to have a look?
I've been there since the fire outbreak.
What's happening there?
They are rebuilding it into a wooden structure again.
Will you be going back there to start your business all over again?
Yes, I have nowhere to go. I don't have money to rent shop for 5 years, $20,000. No, I don't have that money. I don't have money for that.
Nana Yao, I wish you good luck. And I hope that next year when we talk, we'll be saying that this year won't come back again, but next year will be better.
Thank you.
Nana Yao Kese, sneaker shop owner in Kantamantu Market in Accra. Focus on Africa was pulled together by the Trojans, Yvette Twagira Maria, Bella Hassan, and Sunita Nahar here in London. Franny Joey was in Nairobi. Patricia Whitehorn was the senior producer in charge of quality and quantity. Gabriel O'Regan, our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
Hello, I'm Charmaine Cozier. On The Inquiry this week, we're looking at unregulated wines and spirits, including fake alcohol. What makes them toxic and how widespread are they? The Inquiry goes beyond the headlines to explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world. Search for The Inquiry wherever you get your BBC podcasts.